to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. Adventure coming up in this hour. Later on, we hear a strange story from Escape. But right now, a rare broadcast, an audition, in fact, of Safari. Made after World War II, it stars Ray Milland, William Conrad, Joan Banks, and Paul Frees in The Adventure of the Bull Elephant.
Ray Milland in Safari. You're listening to the sound of Africa, her strange tribes, her turbulent waterways, her untamed jungles, her dark and dreadful magic.
This is Ray Milland. During the next half hour, we're going to take you to Africa for the first of a new series of radio adventures called Safari. Authentic stories of the hunt and the hunter, transcribed against the actual background of the African jungle. In a moment, you'll hear the true sounds of the dark continent when, as the white hunter, Philip Sterling, I appear in The Adventure of the Bull Elephant. And now, please join my safari. Hear that? It's a noise for nightmares, trumpeting of a maddened bull elephant. Immense, crafty, dangerous, able to destroy a man with a single motion, the most frightening sound of the jungle. Sometimes I hear it in my sleep, and I wake in the hot, stuffy tent with cold sweat pouring down my arm. For a moment, I think it's only a dream, that I've nothing to worry about, that Philip Sterling will reach a comfortable old age tramping around the eastern end of Africa. Then suddenly my hand shakes as I put the match to my pipe and there's ice on the back of my neck. I've remembered Gunther Evans, the rogue bull, and I'm afraid. To come on it out of the jungle after a long trek through the bush, Nairobi is almost unbelievable. A bright, neon-lit piece of civilization completely surrounded by the primeval darkness of the blue-green jungle that stretches from the Great Rift Valley to the slopes of Kilimanjaro. For the white hunter, it's the city, the place of beginnings and endings, of the sunrise-lit departures and the payoff at the end of the trek, of the continual futile drinking to forget. Officially, it's my home. Philip Sterling, Safaris to Water, Box 1020, Nairobi, Kenya Colony, British East Africa. I live there, but I don't like it. He was sitting in the bar at the New Stanley Hotel. A big, broad-shouldered hunk of a man with graying hair and a black Teddy Roosevelt mustache. There were three or four other Americans in the room, but I knew that he was my man. I knew from the way he laughed, that his head thrown back and his mouth open like the trumpet of a bull elephant.
Wouldn't you know, we come 10,000 miles to Africa and end up in a bar just like Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Mr. Evans?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you must be Sterling. Where have you been? I expected you 2 days ago.
Well, I'm sorry.
Well, I've drunk this place dry waiting for you. Didn't you get my cable? Said the 17th.
Well, I was on safari, and there's no timetable in the jungle, Mr. Evans.
All right. Sit down. Forget it. You're here now. We can get going.
Thank you.
Philip Sterling, huh? And I hope you're as reliable as your name. That's why I picture, you know. I'm a great believer in names, Mr. Sterling. Take mine, for example. Gunther Evans. Gon Evans, they call me. That should make me a crack shot. Well, I am.
And you've hunted big game before?
Moose, mountain lion, grizzly bear, that big enough for you?
Well, it depends on the size of the bear, I should think.
Not bad at all. I like a man who thinks quick. But don't you worry about me, Sterling. You find the game and I'll shoot it. I've never missed a kill yet.
Well, you're very lucky. I have, many times.
I thought you were a professional hunter.
I am.
Yeah. Oh, this is my wife, Felicia. This is Mr. Sterling, our white hunter.
How do you do?
How do you do, Mrs. Evans?
Mr. Sterling's very handsome, isn't he, Felicia?
Why,
Lean and bronzed, very attractive. Attractive to women, that's what you were thinking, huh? You've been watching him ever since he came in. Why not say so? He might like to hear it.
Gun, please.
Your letter mentioned elephants, Mr. Evans, but I presume you're after a fairly representative bag of trophies. Kudu, waterbuck,
don't
antelope.
Don't presume, Mr. Sterling. That's not what I'm paying you for. If I want antelope, I shoot them in Wyoming. I came to Africa for big game. Elephants are the biggest, aren't they?
Unless you'd care to try shooting whales.
All right, I want elephants. And none of those puny representative trophies either. I want a real bull with plenty of tusk. You know, they got one in the museum at home with 200-pound tusks. Well, I've promised them a bigger one.
Now, that's quite an order. Elephants aren't as plentiful as they used to be.
It's your job to turn up game. Can you find it for me or not?
I can find it in the Ngorongoro.
What's that?
Well, it's an extinct volcanic crater on the edge of the Great Rift. It takes a special permit. But it's the best hunting in Africa.
Well, get the permit. I want elephants. I'm willing to pay for them.
Good. But did Mrs. Evans plan to accompany us?
My wife goes where I go.
Ngorongoro is no woman's safari.
Isn't that out of date, Mr. Sterling? I read that there wasn't any danger now, that you traveled by cars and...
Yes, normally. But when you shoot in the salt flats or within a few miles of the so-called roads. But for Ngorongoro, you'll have to trek more than 100 miles on foot. Mostly straight up and down through some of the densest jungle in East Africa.
Then you don't think I should go?
Well, it's not my decision, but I'd advise against it. At best, it'll be uncomfortable. At worst, dangerous. A bull elephant isn't easy game.
Gunn, why don't I wait for you here? I just hold you back. You know how I feel about killing.
What's the matter this time, Felicia? You see a young lieutenant who appealed to you? Or are you planning to look around after I'm gone?
Gunn.
Or are you just a coward like your follower?
All right, Gunn. I'll go.
She was slender, almost too thin to be beautiful, with copper-red hair, that fine-spun texture women always claim they can't manage, and pale, luminous skin. Her face seemed to be all eyes, large, dark, violet pupils set in deep shadows. The eyes of a wounded gazelle who begs for the final bullet that will put an end to pain. Since the dry season was almost over, I had no trouble getting bearers. I picked an even 24. Coastal Swahilis for 10 boys and the rest Bantus and Wambulus from the Victoria Nyanza region. For elephant trackers, 2 Maasai warriors. Once or twice, I thought I noticed Felicia Evans staring at them as they stood by the campfire, leaning on their long-bladed spears, but it may have been my imagination. At any rate, she and Gun Evans seemed to have lapsed into a sullen truce. One of the gun boys had found a baby colubus monkey abandoned by the trail and given it to her for a pet, and she spent most of her time with it, feeding it with an eyedropper and crooning over it as though the thumbless black-and-white creature were a child. Evans drank and oiled his elephant guns and didn't speak to her until the 5th night. We were camped by a Wambula village on the edge of the Great Rift. There were drums in the village and the black native beer, and our bearers made friends easily.
They seem to be having quite a time.
Well, it's the Ngomo of Thanksgiving, a dance of gratitude for having lived through the dry season.
Why aren't those two there, the tall ones with the spears?
Well, they're Maasai warriors. They don't mix with these tribes.
Felicia, stirs your blood, doesn't it? Animal and primitive. It excites you, doesn't it, Felicia?
But don't shout so, Gunn. You frighten
him. Why shouldn't I frighten him? I'm a man. He's a monkey. You'd better let me get rid of him before he's old enough to bite. I'll have him made into a purse when we get back to Nairobi, huh? Or maybe a muff. You're always complaining about cold hands. You could use a muff.
No, thank you.
The idea sickens you, doesn't it? Well, that's the trouble with you, Felicia. That's why you'll never make a good hunter. You're afraid of the very thought of killing.
I just don't like to hurt things, that's all.
Except me.
That's not fair, Gunn. I've tried to be the kind of wife you want. Lord knows I've tried, but... Well, we're different.
You bet we are. I'm not a coward, and you are. Why don't you admit it?
I'm going to my tent.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I want that monkey.
No, Gunn.
I said I want it.
Hold on, Evans.
Get out of my way, Sterling, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Sterling. Good night.
I thought you were smarter than this, Sterling. I hired you to find elephants. Why didn't you stick to your job?
It's my job to keep order in this camp.
You're forgetting something, Sterling. This is my safari. I'm paying for it.
You pay the bills, Mr. Evans, but I run it.
We'll see about that.
And while I run it, it'll be no violence. It's enough that we shoot game without cause.
Another one, huh? All right. Have it your way. How about a little gin rummy? Chilling a point.
No, thanks.
Scared you'll lose?
Last time I played with a client, I wound up owing him for the safari. So I swore off.
Which makes you a kind of coward, too.
It seems to me, Evans, that most of us are, one way or another. Now, if you don't mind, I think I'll turn in.
Go ahead. I'm sticking for a while. I want to keep an eye on those Messiah warriors of yours. They look pretty shifty.
That's Felicia. Come on.
So it's Felicia now. I wondered why you were in such a hurry to start throwing punches.
Come on.
The canvas side of the sleeping tent had been ripped from top to bottom. Black left in the aperture, silhouetted against the night, his green eyes motionless, watching. Felicia was about 6 feet from him in the center of the tent. She snatched up a small caliber Winchester 70, but she was paralyzed with terror, her hands frozen to the rifle, unable to fire. And above her head, the frightened monkeys screeched in panic. Suddenly, the leopard sprang. Evans drew up his gun and fired. The shot was high, dropping the little monkey from the guy rope. The leopard knocked Felicia to the ground and began to worry her with his paws as a cat toys with a mouse. I knew I had time for only one shot. I bent down and pulled the carcass off her motionless body.
Is she all right?
Yes. She's all right. Just fainted. Hardly even scratched. A lucky shot, though.
Yeah, wasn't it?
I guess she'll be upset about the monkey.
You'll get over it.
Funny, I thought you had a clear target when he sprang.
You know how it is, Sterling. Time like that, man gets confused.
Yes, I know. Only I thought you never missed.
What makes you so sure I missed?
By the next evening, we'd reached the end of the car track that passes for the government road to Tanganyika, and were ready to begin the long, tortuous climb through the trackless jungle that lines the 9,000-foot-high escarpment of Ngorongoro. Days were a torture of aching bodies and swarming insects, and the nights a damp, nightmare-filled release. And then at sunset on the fourth day, the rim. A thick gray fog swirled around us, barely 100 miles south of the equator, yet we shivered inside our heavy coats. Then, quite suddenly, the fog lifted. Spread at our feet was an incredible landscape. A flat crater more than 15 miles across, glowing purple and yellow and red with the wild iris and gladiolus, and ridged with the dark green of the forest that clung to the stream beds. Great herds of game ran free across the plains, zebra, eland, grant and Thompson gazelle, hartbeest, wheeling and turning by the hundreds, by the thousands. This was Ngorongoro, fantastic jewel set in the heart of Africa.
It's quite a sight. But I don't see any elephants.
They're here.
They better be.
There were elephants, all right. All around us, feeding on the young growth, moving through the thickets with cat-like silence despite their gigantic bulk. Hundreds of elephants, cows, growing calves, young bulls, but not the heavy old tusker Gunther Evans wanted. At first, he took the hunt with almost boyish enthusiasm. But as the fruitless days of tracking followed one after another, he grew more surly, and our dwindling supply of liquor diminished more rapidly. Hadn't you better go to bed, Evans? You want to get an early start again tomorrow.
Why? What's the difference? You'll never find me a decent elephant. You don't like me, so you won't find me an elephant. Well, all I ask is just one shot at him. Just one shot. I never miss a shot. Stop looking at me like that, Sterling. Accidents can happen, you know. Especially hunting accidents, you ought to know that.
It wouldn't have been an accident.
Wouldn't it? You're wrong, Sterling. I'm a lawyer back home. You didn't know that, did you? Well, I'm a good one, see? Let me tell you, no decent DA would even try to take it to court. Would have been her fault. She had a gun, only she was too scared to shoot. Not my fault. She's a coward.
You don't much like your wife, do you, Evans?
No. No, I don't. I don't like her one little bit.
Why not?
Because I don't like cowards and I don't like cheats. Does that answer your question?
Are you so sure she's either one?
She's my wife, isn't she?
Is that why you brought her here? Is that why you came on the safari? So there'd be an accident? A fatal one?
You ask too many questions, Sterling. That's why you don't find me an elephant. You're too busy asking questions. But I'll tell you, I've nothing to hide. I'm a decent, law-abiding husband. I've spent a lot of money on this joint, a lot of money bringing Felicia along. Now, I ask you, would I go to all this trouble just to get rid of her? Huh? Would I? Huh? Would I?
Hello, Philip. I was wondering when you'd get tired of the orgy and come back here to your tent.
What is it between you, Felicia? Why does he hate you?
Didn't he tell you? He thinks I'm a coward and a... well, no good. Didn't he tell you that?
Something of the sort. Is it true?
My father was Gunn's business partner. He embezzled money from the firm. When he couldn't pay it back, he jumped off a building. Gunn says that's cowardice, that I inherit the tendency. But I wonder if it could be so easy to... kill yourself. What do you think?
I'm not sure. And the rest of it?
Have you ever heard of projection? The need to find your own faults in those closest to you?
Is that it?
You've known me for 3 weeks. What's your opinion?
Well, I'm not sure of that either.
You'd like me to make it easy, wouldn't you, Philip? To run away or make advances. But I'm a woman. I enjoy admiration. I enjoy being chased.
And caught?
Perhaps I'm an elusive quarry. Good night.
Felicia, wait. Be careful. For what he said tonight, I...
Don't worry, Philip. I know all about it. I've known for a long time.
Then why'd you come on the safari? Why'd you come to Africa?
For a silly reason you might never think of. You see, in spite of everything... I'm still in love with my husband. Good night, Philip. Sleep well.
She moved away as silently as a gazelle moving through the reeds at the river's edge. A few minutes later, I fell into a troubled sleep. The sun streaming through my tent opening awakened me, but for a moment I thought I was still dreaming. A grizzled, gray-haired Maasai chieftain was standing on the threshold, leaning on his heavy spear. He wore only a lion skin draped over one shoulder, and heavy brass rings dangled from his earlobes.
Jumbo, Buana.
Jumbo. Habari yasiku niyangi?
Timbo, Buana. Buana, Timbo.
Elephant. Lord Elephant.
Woman.
I hurried into my clothes. I fired a barrage of questions in Swahili at the old warrior. He answered each one slowly and thoughtfully with the careful deliberation befitting a statesman and diplomat whose word is law over 500 square miles of jungle. But by the time Gunther Evans poked his head through the tent flap, I'd heard all I needed to know.
What's the old guy after? A handout? I'm not paying good money to support half the natives in Tanganyika.
Last night, an elephant destroyed a Maasai village, a Bwana elephant, a rogue bull.
A big one?
He says that the tusks drag on the ground when he feeds. 250 pounds of ivory at the very least.
Well, where is this village?
On the outer rim, a half day's trek.
Well, what are we waiting for? Fetch the bearers. I'll wake Felicia.
Wait. Why don't let us stay here, Evans? It'll be a tough trek.
You may be running the safari, Mr. Sterling, but I'll ask you to remember that Felicia is still my wife.
But elephants aren't like other animals, Evans, who run from the guns and fight only when they're cornered. There are hunters among them who kill for sport, and their quarry is a man. And this one's a rogue bull, an old, experienced killer.
My wife goes where I go. You'll take a chance with the rest of us. Oh, I get it. You worried about last night. I was baiting you. Didn't mean a thing.
Didn't it?
All right, I'll make you a deal. I'll take the trackers, you stick with Felicia. If she needs protection, you can give it to her. That's fair enough, isn't it?
I guess so.
Remember, Sterling, she's your responsibility. Look out for her.
We reached the ruined village by mid-afternoon. The spoor led into the thick jungle, following a path worn smooth as marble by the lumbering feet of the thousands of elephants who had come by this route into the Ngorongoro since the beginning of history. Evans and the Maasai beat the woods on one side of the trail, and Felicia and I took the other. And then, without warning, the rain came. Sudden darkness, a peal of thunder, followed by a steady, drenching downpour. We slogged on for nearly a mile, sinking up to our ankles in the mud. I was about ready to turn back when I heard it. The maddened bull was directly in front of us, his great head lifted toward the sky, trumpeting defiance at the elements. I signaled Felicia to back away before he saw us and unleashed my rifle. She nodded and stepped backward, crashing into a dead branch. I had a clear, head-on shot. I aimed, squeezed the trigger carefully, and... my gun useless. Empty. Tampered with empty. Behind me, I heard Felicia's rifle. Empty. Then the elephant came toward us. I threw myself in front of her, knowing full well that there's no shield against that crushing weight. I remember having time to think that Gun Evans had chosen his weapon well. It wasn't every killer who could wield an elephant. And then the brute was there. I threw the useless rifle in his face and caught him full across the mouth. I paused, immobile, as his giant 10-foot ears heard another alien sound. Evans had a box seat for the show atop a neighboring gum tree. My thrown gun had served as comedy relief. Evans tore out the tree and knocked the big man to the ground. Evans raised his gun as he fell, but his finger froze on the trigger, and his face was a mask of fear as the bull dropped to his knees, slowly inexorably bringing his tremendous weight down on Gunther Evans. I got to my feet. But Felicia was ahead of me, running toward the bull, slipping past the writhing trunk, grabbing Evans' rifle, pressing its muzzle against the gray, leathery skin, and pulled the trigger. We carried Gun Evans back to the base camp. The journey that had taken half a day took three, picking a careful route through mud and mire. Felicia stayed beside the litter without sleep, but he only regained consciousness once, to moan for water, to press her hand tightly like a wayward child that begs forgiveness.
It's all right, Gun. Everything's all right now.
Her eyes, when they looked up at me, held no tears. They moved to the gigantic ivory tusks the Maasai trackers were carrying. Then back to Gun's face. Their expression wasn't the gazelle's anymore, but the cool, firm look of the huntress who returns with trophies from the chase. Felicia Evans wore it proudly.
Portions of the program you've just heard were recorded in the jungles of Africa. Featured in the adventure of the bull elephant were Joan Banks as Felicia and William Conrad as Bull Evans. The native was Paul Fries. Safari is written by Robert Yale Libet and directed by Jack Johnstone.
Safari, on Tuned to Yesterday, noted as a post-war broadcast, released for consideration to be a full-fledged series which never came to pass. And it wasn't due to lack of talent, like actors Ray Milland, William Conrad, and Paul Fries, and the capable directing of Jack Johnstone, who after the war directed episodes of The Man Called X, The Hollywood Star Playhouse, and from 1955 to what's known commonly as the final day of the Golden Age of Radio, he directed the mystery program Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, which ended on September 30th, 1962. It's an hour of adventure on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now time for Escape with two actors we just heard, William Conrad and Paul Fries, starring in a CBS broadcast from February 29th, 1948. The story, Grove of Ashtaroth.
Wonder if prices will ever come down. Fed up with the post-war world. Want to get away from it all. We offer you escape. You are standing at the edge of an enchanted grove, lured by a soft, caressing voice inviting you to destruction. You have nearly sold your soul to an ancient goddess from whom you must escape.
Escape, produced by William N. Robeson and designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Today we escape to the African veldt and an enchanted shrine of great antiquity, as John Buchan told it in his weird story, The Grove of Ashtaroth.
We stumbled onto the place, Lawson and I, during the second day after we left Tarki. We'd travel on horseback some 40 miles or so through typical African veldt, lush and green, with plenty of game and good hunting. It was late afternoon when we topped a rise and saw before us a small plateau of such beauty that we both reined in and sat staring at it, not speaking for some moments. A tiny sparkling stream wandered through the verdant meadow grasses, and at the edge of the plateau tumbled in a crystal waterfall down to the plain below. Graceful clumps of strange trees grew here and there, and bushes blazed in a riot of bloom. I'd seen nothing remotely like it in all the miles we'd come. It stood alone, proud and lovely, an alien island in a sea of tropic jungle.
Great heavens, John, in your whole life have you ever seen anything like it? If some artist had designed that plateau, placed every tree and bush by hand, it couldn't be any more perfect. It's almost weird, isn't it?
Yes. It shouldn't be here. It doesn't belong. Well, there isn't a plant growing over there that's like any we've seen in the rest of the jungle.
Probably a difference in minerals in the soil, something of that kind.
It's more than that. They're not even the same varieties.
It's true. That one grove standing alone there near the edge, I've never seen trees that slender and fragile.
And the bark, it looks like silver velvet.
Silver velvet, huh? That's quite an idea, John.
Yes, I guess it is at that. Anyway, those doves seem to like it. They never stop circling over that one particular grove.
They're probably nesting there. A flock of white doves circling over a silver grove. But, you know, there's something vaguely familiar about that.
Yes, there is.
John, can you make out some kind of a dark shape there through the trees over toward the center of the grove?
Yes. Yes. Come on, let's ride over and take a look.
No. Not now.
Huh? Why?
I mean, you'll have plenty of chance to see it later.
What are you trying to say?
John, I'm going to build a home here.
A home? Out here in the middle of the jungle, miles from...
I'll build a road in from Turkey. I've got money enough and no one but me to spend it. I've always wanted to live in Africa.
Always, Lawson? Or for the last 5 minutes?
It doesn't matter. Somehow, even though I'd never seen it, I've dreamed of this spot all my life. I've got to live here. Want to live here, I mean.
But so quickly, at least think it over first.
No, I don't have to think it over. I know what has to be done. John, it's here that I build my tabernacle.
I couldn't understand Lawson giving in to this sudden foolish impulse. It wasn't like him. But there was nothing I could do. I left him at Tarki the next day and returned to the matter-of-fact world of business in London. And it was 3 years before I saw him again. 3 years before I returned to Africa to find that he'd built a manor house in the jungle and equipped it with all the conveniences of the English countryside, of which not the least was Travers, his butler.
May I be so bold as to say it, Mr. Buchan? It's very good to see you again, sir. You bring a breath of old London out of this heathen foreign country.
Well, thank you, Travers. It's good to see you again. This is some different from the old granite front on Grosvenor Square, isn't it?
Indeed it is, sir. A great many things are different.
Yes. Mr. Lawson's turned this jungle clearing into a paradise on earth.
If you'll pardon me, sir, I think paradise is not quite the word.
Oh, well...
Perhaps I'd better tell the master you've arrived, Mr. Buchan. He's been lying down.
Oh, not ill, I hope.
I'll tell him you're here, sir.
Travers left the room and I waited alone, wondering at the strangeness of his manner. I finally decided it must be induced by homesickness. I looked about me, as impressed by the austere magnificence of the library as I'd been by the grounds outside. There was an imposing mantelpiece of ebony at one end, and on it was placed an object elegantly fashioned of alabaster in the form of a half moon. It was curiously carved with signs of the zodiac. There was something compelling, almost unearthly about it. Fascinated, I reached out my hand.
I should not touch that if I were you.
Huh? Oh, Lawson, I didn't hear you come in.
How are you, John?
Oh, fine, Lawson. Couldn't be better. You?
Shall we sit down?
Why, yes. Thank you. It's wonderful seeing you again, old man. Been wanting to get down here for the last 3 years, but you know how it is in London. Time gets away from you, and the first thing you
yes,
know...
Yes, of course. Yes. Cigar?
No. No, thank you. Not now. When I finally did get the chance, I couldn't even wait for an answer from you. I sent a wire and then followed it right on down.
Yes, it surprised me a bit. Haven't had a visitor here for the last 2 years.
Oh? Well, then that explains why Travis talked the way he did. I thought it must be...
What do you mean, Travis talked the way he did? What did he say?
Lawson, what's wrong with you? He didn't say anything.
Well, he'd better not.
I'm afraid I...
Forget it. I'm sorry, Chandler. I haven't felt very well the last few days.
Well, that explains it. I say, at least you seem to be eating all right. You're actually getting a bit plump.
Actually, I'm fat. Gross, flabby, and obscenely fat. Isn't that what you really mean?
Well, no. I was only joking.
Never mind. What do you think of the place, John?
The place? Why, it's amazing. It's beautiful. No one could ever believe it without seeing it. I doubt if there's another place like it anywhere in the world.
You're right about that. There isn't another place like it anywhere in the world.
Oh, that reminds me. I noticed you left the grove as it was without bothering it. Tell me, did you ever find out what it was we saw that afternoon?
Yes. Yes, John, I found what it was.
Well?
John, I have an overseer here, name of McJobson, quite a competent man. I want you to leave with him in the morning, take a 3 or 4 day hunting trip. He knows the country. He'll find you plenty of game.
Oh, but I came here to see you.
I'm fighting about a fever. Happens every so often. I'll be all right by the time you get back.
Oh, now, wait a minute. If you're sick, I'm certainly not going to run.
You'll do what I tell you!
Lawson.
I'm sorry to talk this way, but I know what has to be done.
All right, Lawson. Whatever you say.
Good. Settle it. Believe me, John, I know what's best for me.
Yes. I'm sure you do.
Another thing, John. That carving that sits on the mantel, I must ask you not to touch it. It's quite old and rare. I should not like anything to happen to it.
That night when I retired, I found it impossible to sleep. I tossed fitfully, trying to think of some reason for the great change that came over my friend in these past 3 years. Drugs, drink, actual sickness, either physical or mental? No, none of them gave any complete answer. My windows looked out across to the turf, and I saw the grove of strange trees. It was bathed now in the moonlight by a soft, silvery haze. Even now, in the middle of the night, the flock of doves circled in the air above it, gleaming white from wing and breast as they wheeled in the shafts of moonlight. I dozed off finally, to wake up suddenly in that brief hour before the first light of dawn. I happened to glance from the window, and in the fading moon glow saw a figure approaching the house. It drew nearer, and I saw it was Lawson, barefooted, wearing a white dressing gown. Shortly, I heard his weary steps pass my door, and afterward, the house was silent. I lay there wide awake. Lawson had been coming from the direction of the grove.
Good morning, Mr. Buckton.
Oh, morning, McJobson. Oh, sit down, sit down.
Thank you, sir. Now, in regards to that hunting trip we talked about, I can offer you a choice of 2 or 3...
No, never mind. I'm not going on any hunting trip.
But last night we decided...
Last night, McJobson. Tell me, how long has Mr. Lawson been sick?
Oh, it comes and goes. Happens about once a month like this. He's not the man that he was when I first came here.
Do you have any ideas about what might be the matter?
Aye.
Well, what are they?
If I told you what was in my head, you'd think me daft. Why don't you wait until tomorrow? You won't need to ask. It's a full moon the next.
Full moon? What does that have to do with it?
You'll find it in the Bible. Read the 11th chapter of the 2nd book of Kings. Good day, sir.
I found a Bible in the library and thumbed it open to the passage he'd mentioned. I read through it once without understanding. And then one sentence seemed to leap out from the page. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians. Ashtaroth. Ashtaroth, of course, Ashtaroth. Goddess of the ancient East, whose strange rituals held a dark fascination for the children of Israel, over and over luring them away from their fierce prophets to worship at her shrines. The white doves of Ashtaroth circling the shrine of her silver grove. Why, then the grove at the end of the turf must hide a lost shrine dedicated to her worship. But what of Lawson? Did his blood carry one fraction from old Israel with the same ancient weakness to hear and answer the call of the goddess? Had he become an acolyte of Ashtaroth? What weird rites did he perform in the grove at night? And then I remember tonight. The worship of Ashtaroth had always reached its climax on the night of the full moon. Lawson did not appear all day. And that evening, after dinner, McJobson and I took up our watch on the dark veranda, looking into the windows of the library. We'd been there at least an hour.
Look. That's Mr. Lawson. Just came into the library.
I see him. Wait. What's he after?
I suppose he wants the little figure on the mantle.
We watched him take the carved half moon of alabaster and slip it into the pocket of the robe he was wearing. Then he turned and left the room. In a moment, he came out the front door and walked off across the turf in the moonlight.
He'd best give him a bit of a start and then follow him.
No, he'd see us for sure in that moonlight.
I do not think so. He'd not look back now, sir, if there were 10 of us following.
But, Jobson, what is it all about?
You've read the book?
Yes. Yes, it's the ancient goddess Ashtaroth, but what is the ceremony? What does he do? And what is it that made him the way he is?
The ceremony you'll be seeing, Mr. Buchan. As to what has made him like he is, he does an evil thing. And all the while he knows it to be evil. He's trying to help himself, and he knows that too.
Yes, I think I see what you mean.
We'd best be going now. He's gone into the grove.
We crossed the turf quickly and passed into the black and silver shadows of the moonlit grove, working our way carefully toward the center. The only sound at first was the piping of the doves circling high over the lacy branches above our heads. I saw as we approached that the center of the grove had been cleared to form a small circular arena. It was covered with smooth turf. And standing in the middle of it was a cone of rock 30 feet high, a smooth, sharp tower of stone that pointed up toward the tops of the trees. And then I saw Lawson. He stood by the base of the conical tower, his arms uplifted, the symbol of the half moon bound to his forehead, enchanting words with meanings I could not even guess. Now Lawson threw off his white robe and began a curious kind of dance, moving around the foot of the cone on a worn path beaten in the turf, the same path he must have followed many other nights before. He moved faster and faster, uttering now and again a wild cry. We stared entranced at the circle of moonlight. And as he danced, a strange new sound slipped into my consciousness, an earthly melody that seemed to come from the tower, from the trees.
Or may perhaps have been born within my own mind, tricked by the magic fantasy of moonlight, shadows, and perhaps madness. It brought to me one vivid thought of the warm, soft lips of an unseen goddess, of lips incarnadine, whispering gently and sensuously across the reeds of a penpipe. I stirred uneasily, felt the quickening of my pulse.
If you try to resist it, Mr. Buchan, 'tis only a thing of evil cloaked in a false beauty.
McJobson heard or felt it too. Then it was more than a trick of my own senses. Something in me thrilled to the call of the weird melody. I wanted to rush out and throw myself at the base of the stone tower to dance as Lawson was doing, to spend all eternity in adoration and worship of the beauty of Ashtaroth.
No, Mr. Buchan. Think what it's done to him. Fight it, lad. Fight it.
I lost all knowledge of time. The dance had grown swifter and fiercer. The moonless figure in the clearing moved faster and faster, posturating and gyrating in tempo to the crazy rhythm. My blood was pounding in my throat, my ears ringing. The music surged through my brain in ever-mounting waves of incandescent sound. Now I was beyond reason, possessed by an overpowering frenzy when... the cock crew.
Then the grove was deathly still, and at the foot of the tower, Lawson lay unconscious.
How is he, Mr. Buchan?
He's lost a lot of blood, but I think he'll be all right.
Good. It was a near thing.
Trevor's got a couple of sleeping tablets into him. He'll not be waking up before tonight, at least. McJobson, I suppose you know what we have to do.
I'm well aware of what should be done, sir. But I've no idea how to do it.
I think I do. I shall take full responsibility, but I'll need men, all we can get.
The natives will no go near the place. But there's some 30 white men on the tobacco farm a few miles back on the bush. But they want a highway.
I'll pay it, just get them.
Would you mind telling me what you're proposing to do, sir?
Yes. Something that may sound as mad as Lawson himself. I'm going to deal with that grove the same way King Josiah did.
Hey, it comes back to me vaguely.
Yeah. Here it is. And the high places that were before Jerusalem, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had builded for Ashtaroth, the abomination of the Sidonians, did the king defile. And he brake in pieces the images and cut down the grove. Both the altar and the high place he brake down, and burned the high place, and stamped it small to powder, and burned the grove.
Aye, 'tis the word of God. I need dynamite, but I have plenty of it down at the workshop. I'll go after the men first. We should be ready to start by 9 o'clock this morning.
It was just past 9 when we entered the grove, carrying axes and a couple of shotguns, and driving several teams of oxen. A light breeze had sprung up, and it whispered and rustled in the branches of the silver trees. We took care of the doves first, shot them one by one until we'd killed them all, 27, then piled their white bodies at the foot of the pointed rock. Then the men set to work with the axes, chopping through the slender trunks of the trees.
Those little finger trees in every bush. Drag them into pine.
Right, you are, sir.
All right, come on.
I stood by the stone tower, the high place of King Solomon, and watched while the work went on. Gradually borne, perhaps, in the sighing wind, a strange fancy crept into my mind.
Oh, no. Please don't. Please, no.
I fancied I could hear a voice coming from the tower, from the trees. His voice was soft, warm, and pleading.
Listen with your heart. Can the spirit within you not hear and see you?
The heart of all sorrow was in that voice, and the soul of all loveliness. Distant, tenuous, with all the bodiless grace of a goddess older than time and desire.
Please listen. Can you not know that I am beautiful, and once gone, I'm gone forever?
I could not believe that I was imagining this soft and lovely voice. I felt a sudden and overpowering adoration for this exquisite creature who whispered in the breath of the wind. I wanted to call out to the men, order them to stop desecration of her home and sanctuary. Then I thought of Lawson, of what he'd become, and I fought back the impulse.
How can you judge who knows so little? One who is part of the whole divinity of nature?
No. No, I won't. I can't listen to you.
Look at me but once with the eyes of your heart, and you'll belong to me forever.
No. Please, no.
You have killed my doves, covered their white breasts with blood. Are you not yet satisfied?
It's got to be done. It's got to be done.
No, please. You could stop now. And leave the high place. New trees would grow, and other doves would come and nest in them.
But I can't. I can't.
What did you say, Mr. Buchan? I couldn't quite hear you.
Hmm? Oh, nothing. Nothing at all.
Well, I'm ready to put the dynamite around the tower here, if you'll move back a little way.
McJobson, perhaps. Perhaps we could leave the tower. Maybe it's enough to clear the grove.
Tis not enough. The book says, and their children remember the altars and the groves by the green trees upon the high hills.
No.
That's no good, Mr. Buchan. Pay no heed to the voices of the wind. Every last stone must be destroyed.
Listen to the heart of the spirit within you.
No.
He is a stern man. And the cruel man, and his words are vile with hate.
No.
Leave me only this one last call.
No. All right, McJobson. Go ahead with it.
Place the boxes of dynamite close together, lads. Easy now.
No. Even now, it's not too late.
I walked away slowly. The piles of tree trunks were burning now. The smoke swirled in the wind. I would leave this place tonight. Yes, I would leave this place forever. Then write a note for Lawson, telling him of what I'd done. And I was very tired.
Oh, please, listen, while there's yet time. The thing once done can never be undone. And once gone, I can never return.
I knew that my act, my reason told me all these things. I knew that this act that I'd committed had saved Lawson. Had saved his life and perhaps his reason. And yet I wondered if perhaps in so doing I was not driving from its very last refuge on earth something that was so rare and lovely. If perhaps I was not destroying a very beautiful thing. A very beautiful thing forever.
stop now. Please, oh, please.
All right. Another phone.
No. Oh, no. No. No.
By William N. Robeson, directed by Norman McDonald, today brought you The Grove of Ashtaroth by John Buchan.
Escape, on Tuned to Yesterday from February 29th, 1948 on CBS. And that wraps this hour of adventure on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for tuning in.